others. No, not exactly. And I don't suppose you've had any word from inside Lethe? They went dark soon after we undocked. About 20 minutes ago we picked up a small seismic event, and if we've localized it correctly, it was near the top of the elevator shaft. Am I missing something here, Prefect? If you are, Captain Pell, you're not the only one. I'm taking the cutter into the docking port. Give me covering fire if I run into the surface defenses, will you? Are you sure you don't want to dock with us first? No time. Once I'm docked, return to Panoply. Disregard any contravening orders you receive between now and then. You'll be debriefed upon arrival. Why would I disregard? Just do it, Pell. The cutter veered hard for Lethe. Marlon Voy regarded Julius with a look composed of equal parts admiration and venom, not a little impressed by the thing he had brought into the world, and not a little horrified by it as well, it seemed to Julius. "Let me tell you what I already figured out for myself, while I still had the chance," Julius said, with a sort of chilly bonhomie. "Caleb and I were never your sons. You and Mother?" His voice caught as his thoughts dwelled on the image of her, dead on the ground, brought low by his own hand. "You weren't our real parents. We were raised by you, and you went to a lot of trouble to make us feel like your natural heirs. But we were never your flesh and blood. That was all a lie." They were walking behind Lurcher as the robot trudged back to the house. The robot was carrying the body of Alia Voy, lolling in its arms just as if she had fallen asleep. Marlon and Julius were carrying the equally limp form of Caleb, who was alive but unconscious. Julius had permitted the robot to administer an additional sedative to his brother, taking no chances with Caleb causing further trouble. "You're wrong," Father said. "It's not how you think it was. You have our genes. You were both Voys. Didn't you see it in your faces when you compared them with our own, or the portraits in the house?"
"Faces can be made to look any way you like," Julius said.
"There wasn't any need to. You are our sons."
"We had dreams, Father. We were part of something that happened far too long ago for us to be your sons."
Father nearly stumbled under his share of Caleb's burden. "You were never meant to remember any of that."
"Any of what, exactly?"
"It's best left as is. The less you recollect, the happier you'll be."
"I just shot and killed my own mother, Marlon."
He said his father's name deliberately, certain of the hurt it would cause.
"Remind me why I'm meant to feel happy about anything."
"You don't know how much worse it could be." Father, Marlon, paused, needing to draw breath before they continued. It was a long, winding route back to the shell house, and he was not accustomed to exercise. "Was it really a trick, Julius?"
"Yes. Caleb made me see a lion. He placed the figment in my head. That's what I thought I was shooting."
Marlon seemed to accept the plausibility of this explanation. Perhaps he had seen enough of Caleb's spitefulness and talent for manipulation to form his own judgment. "Then Caleb made a deliberate choice to have Alia murdered?"
"He was afraid she'd revoke our powers, with or without your agreement. She was thinking of it, wasn't she?"
"She saw something in your brother that concerned her, yes."
"And me? Was I a concern?"
"She thought you had a wiser head on your shoulders, or were kinder, at least."
"I think she was a little wrong about both of us. She couldn't have guessed Caleb would go that far. Even I didn't realize."
"You got your retribution, from the looks of it. What have you left of his brain, Julius?"
"Oh, enough. He'll be fine when he comes round, eventually."
Julius reached out to give Marlon an encouraging shove.
"Come on. The sooner we're back at the shell house, the sooner I can explain how things are going to be from now on."
Marlon's eyes registered fear. "What exactly do you have in mind?"
"Oh, nothing too serious as far as you're concerned. I'll be leaving, but once I've set myself up in the outside world, I still want access to the family money, which means there can't be any scandal surrounding the Voy estate."
"A murder isn't serious enough for you."
"We'll have to make it look like something other than a murder, won't we?"
Julia said this as if he were explaining something to a child, which was not greatly at odds with the way he now felt about Marlon.
"You and I, We'll rub heads and think of a way to explain her death. Make it look like an accident. A great tragedy. It'll put an awful toll on you, of course, so you'll withdraw from public life, even more than you already have. But you'll still be here, and so will Caleb. I'll leave the two of you to stew in your own guilt.
You can't go anywhere, Marlon said. The world isn't ready for you. You don't even exist. Legally, I mean.
Oh, I figured that out already. I'm a non-entity. A non-citizen.
Julius spared a hand to tap the side of his head.
But you've instilled a great gift in me, Marlon. I can choose to become whatever and whoever I want. I can alter any packet of data I wish, any record. I can make a past for myself, a name and a history that feels as real as anyone else's. Admit it. You were going to have to lie about us eventually, weren't you?
Not this way. Not now.
It's sooner than I'd have liked as well, Julia said. But it's not my fault that Caleb brought this on us.
You can't just leave,
Marlon said.
You don't know what's out there, what's really out there. You're not prepared.
Then you'll show me.
Julius replied. They brought the bodies to the shell house. Alia was placed in one room, while Caleb's unconscious form was taken to the one where Julius had found the sleeping Dr. Stasov. Julius told Lurcher to monitor Caleb and sedate him if he woke up. Marlon tried to give an overriding order to the robot, but Julius had reached inside Lurcher and given himself command precedence. Marlon persisted long enough to establish that he had no authority over the robot, at least not while Julius was present. Some fleeting, furtive notion played across Marlon's face. Julius felt the tickle as Marlon tried to reach into his skull, attempting to issue the revocation command.
No,
he said gently, pushing his father's intrusion aside with more tenderness than he felt.
That won't work. I can see how the blocking action works and what I need to do to circumvent it. It's actually pretty easy. I wish I'd seen it sooner. Then I could have told Caleb not to worry about either of you being able to revoke our powers.
Marlon tried again. Julius rebuffed him with a little more force.
Now what?
Marlon asked, drained of hope, his options exhausted.
Nothing bad.
Julius tried a reassuring smile. You're just going to stay here and keep doing what you do. I know it'll be lonely, but you'll adjust. Make of Caleb what you will. He's of no interest to me now.
But Alia...
Her death will have to be explained, yes. I've an idea, but it's a little tricky, and you'll need to cooperate on your end of the story. But you'll have a great incentive to do so, so that shouldn't be a problem.
They'll see she was murdered.
Then there can't be much of a body left for anyone to pick over.
Julius brightened as he felt his plan gaining connective tissue.
She's been going into space a lot lately, since you can't be bothered to leave the shell house. That's true, isn't it?
Marlon's look was distrustful.
What of it?
We'll use that to our advantage. Put her body into the private shuttle, send it into orbit, then have it malfunction on the way back. Burn up, crash. Leave just enough genetic material to satisfy the curious. No suspicion would be attached to you. Far from it. You'd be the tragic widower, the latest in a line of Voys to be burdened by a terrible twist of fate.
Why wouldn't they suspect me?
Because you wouldn't have the means to make an accident like that happen, even if you wanted to.
Julia shrugged.
It's easy for me, though. How can you be so cold about this?
I'm just reverting to type, Marlon. Springing back to the monster you've always known me to be. What was it Dr. Stasov said when you were arguing with Mother, Alia? You were making monsters out of monsters?
You don't know what you were.
But a single shudder ran through Marlon as he found some desperate composure.
You'll help me dispose of the body, like you said.
Good,
but not the way you think.
He took Julius to the edge of the dome, to the spot where Lurcher had been repairing the panels. They stood together, father and son, looking out at the lights and towers of Chasm City.
"You think it's yours for the taking,"
Marlon said eventually, "close enough to touch, a dream of a city waiting to bend itself to your will, or those millions of lives, hardly knowing the force that's heading their way, the power you've imagined.
The things you could do with that power.
What of it?
Do you see that panel that's a little cleaner than the rest? Marlon nodded to make his point. See if you can remove it.
Don't be silly. Caleb and I tried forcing every panel on the perimeter when we were younger. The more you told us we weren't old enough to go into Chasm City, the more we wanted to.
You weren't as strong then. Anyway, there's a knack to it. Press the panel against its frame, then apply a little clockwise rotational force. The seal should release.
If it was that easy,
do it, Marlon said.
Something in that command compelled Julius to obey, as if permitting Marlon one last order for old time's sake.
He moved to the panel, braced himself, glancing back in case there was some trick about to be sprung on him, and settled his palms on the cold, clean glass of the panel. He did as Marlon had instructed, and after sufficient resistance to have deterred a younger version of himself, he felt the glass click and unlock from its seal. Carefully, Julius extracted the panel and set it down on the ground, resting against the bottom edge of the dome. A chilly draft touched his face. He raised his eyes to the gap in the dome, expecting to see Chasm City's lights with more clarity and brightness than before. Now there was no glass between him and the city. There was only darkness. His senses robbed of distant reference points, Sparva had to keep reminding himself that he was inside a cold lump of tumbling rock, not on the surface of some verdant, abundantly forested planet. Every footstep was taking him along the arc of a slowly curving floor, but with the oppressive sensory overload of the jungle, it was impossible to tell he was walking on anything but a level surface.
"I saw something ahead on the feed," Peric announced, when they were two-thirds of a kilometre in from the clearing. "Just for a second, when there was a gap in the cover. Looked like a big structure, a kilometre or so further on. Maybe less. Hard to judge how big or how far away it was. Feels like this path is taking us there, whatever it is."
Sparva had also seen something, but the glimpse had been too brief to offer anything substantial. Whatever it was, they would get there soon enough, he felt certain. It took less than a minute for the party to reach the point where the Whiphound had gained that momentary glimpse of the structure, but the jungle seemed to have closed that particular sightline. Peric crouched down to approximate the Whiphound's dog-like viewpoint, then used her own unit to hack away some more of the foliage, all to no avail. From his vantage point behind her, Sparva noticed an odd subliminal flicker on the Whiphound's second edge, where it encountered the greenery.
"Everything all right, Dahlia?"
"Just some resistance, Prefect Bancal."
But she turned around to face Koba. "Did you lock in the effectors setting on this unit?"
"There's nothing wrong with my Whiphound," Koba said,
trailing off when he noticed, in common with the offers, the abrupt termination of the visual feed from Peric's forward scout unit.
"That's not normal," Gurney said.
Sparva had begun to notice the flickering effect on his own Whiphound, a spangle of blue and pink flashes emanating from the cutting edge whenever it came into contact with any part of the jungle. The effort of swinging the blade was becoming harder, as if the cutting edge were dulling, meeting resistance. A deep apprehension settled in his gut.
"Close up, Whiphounds," he snapped. "Nobody cut or touch anything. This isn't a jungle."
"What the hell is it?"
Peric asked.
"Quick matter. Somehow.
Certainly whatever the Whiphounds touched, and maybe everything we can see. We're deep in the middle of it."
"That's—"
But Peric must have caught herself before she offered reflex contradiction.
"This jungle goes on for kilometres. If it's all quick matter, we've never seen or trained for anything like this sort of concentration."
"Quick matter can't hurt us," Koba said.
"There are safeties. We can conjure it out of the way."
Koba used his free hand to make a conjuring gesture, palm to the jungle, fingers outspread, pushing back against air. The jungle should have detected his desire and at least made a show of partial retreat, but there was no response.
"It's not obeying," Peric said.
"It won't,"
Sparva said.
"Not for us. Maybe not even for someone with a head full of implants. Someone else is controlling it. The best we can hope for is that we don't provoke it."
They snapped their filaments back into their handles, clutching the Whiphounds like truncheons, and advanced carefully along the path, all too conscious of the blades and fronds that brushed against their suits.
Soon they came to what was left of Peric's whiphound. It was on the ground, filament flicking limply, sparks dancing from the blade to the handle. Peric made to reach for it. "No," Sparva said. She jerked back her hand in time. A network of fine green cilia had already begun to wrap itself around the handle. Where the jungle floor touched it, the whiphound was losing form, its edges turning furry. It was in the process of being dismantled, its parts absorbed into the self-replicating mass of the jungle. "We'd better get some distance from it," Sparva said. "Gurney, Singh, get back to the clearing and see if you can ride that elevator back up to the entry shaft. Instruct Panoply that we need an immediate enforcement action with quick matter specialization."
Yes, sir,"
Singh said. "We'll see if we can make it back." Gurney and Singh set off back the way they had come, walking at first, then breaking into a jog just before their black suits passed out of sight. Sparva watched them go with profound unease, uncertain if he had improved their chances or just made them worse. "Let's keep moving," he said resignedly, while Peric's whiphound sparked and fizzed in its grassy crib. "This path was cleared for us for a reason."
"I don't like it,"
Peric said. "Me neither, but I'm not turning back just yet, not while we're still dealing with wildfire." They quickened their pace. Their whiphounds might have had their filaments retracted, but that did not mean they were totally useless. Peric was taking the lead, sweeping her whiphound back and forth like a wand or divining stick, relying on the scanning and threat detection systems to offer some advance warning of trouble. Sparva followed with his back to Koba, unnerved, but not entirely surprised to see that the walls of the trail seemed to press together once they had passed, leaving barely any trace of the path they had followed. Singh and Gurney were still moving, at least. Their feeds were still playing, and Peric kept checking back with them for verbal updates. "It's not resisting us just yet," Singh reported. "Good," Peric said. "Maintain your pace and stay calm." The world suddenly turned white, and after a soundless instant, a shockwave hit Sparva just as if he had walked into an unyielding door. After images fogged his eyes. Through pained slits, he watched the whiteness die away to a sullen, green-filtered glow. Overhead, where the gaps in the canopy still allowed glimpses of blue, a soot-black cloud billowed and rose and dissipated. The prefects paused for a moment, then resumed their advance, not needing to dwell on the obvious facts of the whiphound malfunction. "Gurney, Singh, were you clear?" Peric asked.
"Clear,"
Singh said. "Inertial fix says we're within 100 meters of the start point." "Good. If you're luck, Singh, that elevator's still waiting at this end of the shaft." A red outline showed on Sparva's faceplate, pulsing for his attention. It defined a low, cryptic form, a blob of matter moving somewhere ahead of them, hidden from his eyes by layers of intervening foliage.
"Tracking it?"
Peric said, tension in her voice. "Permission to deploy second edge?"
"Keep it sheathed,"
Sparva said. "We want to stay on the right side of this jungle."
"Damn it, Bankal," she hissed. "There's something moving out there."
Sparva decided to ignore the breach of etiquette. "Easy, Field. If your whiphound detects an approaching threat, it will still go fully autonomous. Its reflexes are 1,000 times faster than your own, so start trusting them."
"I think I saw it," Koba said breathlessly. "Something black behind the ferns. Just for a moment."
Sparva was still directing most of his attention to the rear of the trio.
"What did it look like?"
"Not sure, sir. Big? Low? I think I saw eyes. Some sort of animal."
"Keep moving," he said, as much for his own benefit as the others. The whiphounds were still targeting the moving form, but the quick matter was obviously confusing their acquisition and range-finding faculties, the shape remaining amorphous and poorly separated from the confusion of surrounding forms. There was no surprise to be had in that, Sparva thought. He thought it highly unlikely it was made up of flesh and blood.
"I see a second trace,"
Peric said.
"Something else moving on the other side of the trail. They're coming closer."
"What the hell are those things?"
"Cats,"
Koba said. "I'd really feel better with a sword in my hand," Peric said.
"Go ahead,"
Sparva relented, deciding that a psychological boost was what counted now. "1 meter extrusion, and keep that edge away from any part of the jungle." Sparver unclipped his second whiphound and deployed its traction filament. Protective cordon only, no second edge until I give the order. Proceed. The whiphound nodded and began to loop around the trio, whisking through the foliage, but making no effort to clear away any part of it. Sparver then deployed his primary whiphound in sword mode, almost ashamed at how much better he felt when he had that time-honored weapon in his grasp. They moved on, the black shapes prowling close, but not yet letting themselves be seen. At last, through a thinning in the canopy, Sparver caught the white apex of the structure at the middle of the dome and realized they could not be far from it now. Maybe only a few hundred meters. Whatever the nature of the building, its curving, spiraling architecture was more organic than geometric. The path kinked. Ahead, emerging quite abruptly, was an opening, a smaller version of the earlier clearing, where at least two trails crossed each other. Sparver had the sense that the opening had not existed until they were very close to it, the quick matter foliage reorganizing itself like a clever stage set, falling into place just in advance of the actors. That was the least of his concerns, though. A huge black cat blocked their way. Its stance was assertive, four powerful paws planted on the ground, its long body a study in predator biomechanics, its tail curled high behind it, its head and neck lowered with belligerent intent, two preternaturally yellow eyes gleaming. The cat was an absence with eyes, a moving ink blot with sentience. Slowly the mouth widened, white teeth gleaming into visibility. The cat took a forward step. Sparver's whiphound gathered itself into a bundle and flung itself at the cat, extruding its filament to the fullest extent as it spun through the air. Sparver only had time to observe, not to react. His whiphound tried to wrap itself around the cat. Instead, the filament slipped all the way through, even as the cat remained whole. The whiphound redoubled its efforts, confused but determined, gamely convinced it could still disable this identified threat. Still, its coils fell through the cat, as if it were made of smoke. Now a second cat emerged into the clearing, eyes and teeth flaring from the perfect void of its body. The first cat had wearied of the whiphound's efforts. With an insouciant paw flick, it sent the whiphound tumbling into the jungle, whereupon there was an immediate flicker of pink and blue sparks. Sparver pushed to the front of the party. He still had his primary whiphound. He knew that the cutting edge would achieve nothing against the cat's. He pulled in the filament and leveled the handle at the closest cat. Mark target, grenade mode, minimum yield, contact fuse. He lobbed the whiphound, then sprung around and flung himself to the ground. Perek and Koba followed his lead, and then a white pulse bleached the world, accompanied by a shockwave and a burst of heat that Sparver felt all the way through his M-suit. Koba was already giving a similar order to his own whiphound. Mark targets, grenade mode. Don't waste your time, Perek said. Sparver stumbled to his feet and turned to assess the damage. The whiphound had excavated a small crater in the floor of the clearing, but the first cat was reconstituting itself, tributaries of black flowing in from all directions, pouring out of the ground as if it bled some dark, living ichor. The other cat had not been hurt at all. Now the second quickened its pace. They had two whiphounds left. Protective cordon, Sparver said. Both units. That's all we can hope for. They can't stop those cats, but maybe they can keep them from reaching us for a few minutes. And after that? Perek asked. The whiphounds formed their cordon, a moving corral around the party. The trio advanced into the blasted clearing. The cats, the first now fully reconstituted, closed in on the cordon from either side, prowling around it like a pair of orbiting moons. A voice blared into his skull, breathless and anxious. This is Singh. We're back at the starting point, but the elevator's gone. Then summon it, Perek said with admirable calm, little in her answer betraying their present circumstances. I have, but I can't tell if it's responding or not. It's kilometers to the other end of that shaft. We've got another problem. I think something's been tracking us. We're picking up shapes, things, closing in on the clearing. Here's some advice, Perek answered. Don't engage. Find the best cover you can and get behind a defensive cordon. Repeat, do not engage. Yes. Understood. We're at the pit now. There's something else, too. We found two things in the pit that weren't there when we left. Giving you visual now, Prefect Perrick. Please advise.
Thank you, Singh. I see what you're seeing.
Sparva saw it as well, projected onto his faceplate. The image was shaky, as Singh fought to control his nerves. Lying in the pit, side by side, perfectly formed, as neat and solid as if they had been there all the time, was a pair of crossbones.
"Don't touch anything you don't have to," Perrick said. "You'll be all right, Singh, as soon as that elevator arrives."
The cats continued circling the party, occasionally testing the whiphounds with a lunge or a feint. Sparva had to admit that his knowledge of actual cats was not exhaustive, but something in the way these forms moved and behaved convinced him that some fundamental feline algorithm was governing their actions.
"Look," Koba said, "ahead on the trail, three of them, just like the ones in the pit."
Koba was right. Three crossbows lay waiting, one for each of them, only a few meters beyond the front of the moving cordon. Something flicked from the jungle, a blur of green, and one of the two whiphounds vanished. One of the cats saw its moment and flung itself at Koba, bringing him down instantly. The other cat joined its mate, and the two of them hauled Koba's flailing, scrabbling form into the jungle, a curtain of green opening and then closing behind them. Sparva saw his own moment, too. He sprang forward and snatched up two of the crossbones, even as the third seemed to be melting back into the ground. He tossed one of the weapons to Perrick, who caught it one-handedly. Even as he did this, the final whiphound was snatched away into the greenery.
"It's a game," he said,
struck by a sudden, lurching intuition.
"The jungle's setting the rules, not us. We can hunt or be hunted, but this is all we get to use."
He examined the crossbow. It was a simple, if elegant, thing. Lodged in the groove of its barrel was a single arrowed projectile, finned and barbed like a miniature spaceship. Off in the distance, Koba was screaming.
"We've got to help him,"
Perrick said, staring down at her own crossbow, her hand shaking.
"He's gone,"
Sparva said, surprising himself with the firmness of his response.
"Understand that. He's beyond any help you or I are capable of giving."
He raised his own crossbow, sighting along the groove.
"Our duty now is not to die, if at all possible. We have a mission, an enforcement action, so I suppose we'd better make these things count."
"This isn't how I thought it would play out."
"Me neither." He started walking, trusting the trail to take him nearer to the structure he had glimpsed earlier.
"But it's a better-than-zero chance, and if those are the only odds we get, we'd better make the most of them. I'm willing to bet we only get one shot with these things. Wait until there's no chance of missing."
It was a relief of sorts when Koba fell silent, but only a small one, because that silence surely meant the cats would soon move on from the temporary distraction he had provided. Sparva and Perrick continued their advance, the trail opening up ahead of them, thickening and closing behind. Sparva was struck by an unwelcome mental image, that they were two pieces of food being squeezed along a digestive tract. It was not a position he much enjoyed finding himself in, but he was under no illusions that the jungle would not punish any attempt to ignore or negate the game.
"Whatever happens to us,"
Perrick said, twisting around to cover their rear, "this is only going to end one way for whoever's behind this. Panoply will tear this place apart, quick matter or not. Even if the Supreme Prefect has to petition for the use of special weapons, they'll give it to her this time. All the way to nukes." Perrick was breathing hard, and Sparva guessed that talking was her preferred psychological defense mechanism when under intense stress.
"No one wants to think about a motherload of hostile nanotechnology drifting through the glitter band like a rogue cancer. They'll use whatever it takes to turn this place to dead ashes."
Sparva twitched his crossbow to the left and right, seeing cats where there were just black shadows.
"Your point being, this feels like some sort of suicidal endgame, like we've been lured into a house someone's preparing to burn to the ground.
That's a cheering thought, Dahlia."
But it was one he shared, whether or not he cared to admit it. That image of the digestive tract flashed back to him. They had been shepherded to this point long before they reached the jungle, he knew. Perhaps from the moment the flood brought Talia and him to Elysium Heights, if not sooner. coaxed and prodded when they thought they were making independent deductive leaps, so that their actions were always destined to bring them to this place, the arena of this terminal game. And with a shiver of insight, one whose steps he could not have easily diagrammed, even to his own contentment, Sparver intuited that this process had begun not with wildfire, not with the crisis of the last 400 days, but years or decades earlier. Some great slow mechanism had been set in patient motion, and this was the culmination of it. "There's an opening," Peric said, excited and fearful in the same breath. "It's the heart of the chamber. We'll be safer there."
"You think?"
"Better than this. We'll have a chance of spotting the cats before they close in. And maybe there's some rock, some inert matter, that we can get to. We just need a bridgehead, something we can defend until Panoply arrive." Ahead, the path widened out, edges of foliage framing a large open area, consisting of a concentric pattern of formal gardens, encircling the tall building whose spiral, organically derived architecture he had already glimpsed. There were windows, set at haphazard intervals, into the ascending, coiling levels, and doors at the base, facing onto a slightly elevated terrace. "It's the shell house," Sparver said. "I recognize it from the Garlin case files. But it shouldn't be here. He was born and raised in Chasm City. Could it be quick matter?" Sparver wanted to offer some reassurance, some consoling hint that they might find safety in the structure. But Peric deserved better than that. "Whatever it is, I don't trust it, though it seems to be waiting for us, and it would be rude to turn down an invitation. Perhaps the cats have given up on us for now."
"That would be nice,"
he said, clutching his crossbow tight as they broke out of the jungle into the central area. There was no sign of company, an observation that did nothing to lessen his nerves. They crept into the open together, back to back and circling slowly as they moved. They were moving along a dirt-lined path, hemmed by rock gardens that had the same too vivid coloration as the foliage in the jungle, the plants and flowers almost migraine bright. Peric jerked suddenly, her elbow jabbing into his back.
"I thought..."
She caught her breath.
"Just a shadow was all. I'm sorry."
"Don't apologize. It's all right to be twitchy." They walked and circled, gradually narrowing the distance to the shell house.
"Can I say something, sir?"
"You say what you like, Dahlia." He sensed her hesitation before replying. "I'm glad it was you they sent us, sir."
"Glad it was me, or glad it was a hyperpig?"
"Both, sir." "You have a reputation and... Well, if there was anyone I'd sooner be in this mess with, I can't think of who they are."
"Hmm."
Sparver mulled this, not entirely certain of how he was meant to take it.
"And this reputation of mine? You tend to come out of things, sir, in one piece."
"It helps being small," Sparver said. "We get overlooked. Also, we're good at squeezing out of places. I'm sure there's more to it than that."
"You'd be..."
But he stopped, his heart racing. He had seen something, some liquid pooling of shadow and light on the periphery of the open area, near the point where they had emerged from the jungle. He raised the crossbow, aimed it at the spot, and was an instant away from firing when he decided the pattern was illusory, just his brain making a cat out of chaos. He breathed out, made to lower the crossbow. Peric fired. He felt the recoil, her back to his. Slowly he turned, wanting and not wanting to see a cat, because that would mean that she had not wasted her bolt. By way of a bonus, too, it would be good if the cat were dead or dying. But there was nothing.
"I thought..."
Peric started.
"I was sure. I saw it. It was there, coming out of the green."
"I believe you," Sparver said. Peric lowered her crossbow.
"I shouldn't have fired. I've wasted the bolt."
"It's not your fault. Whatever you saw, it's what this place wanted you to see." Sparver took a step away from her.
"Dahlia, I'm going to ask you to accept an order. You'll take this."
He made to pass her his own crossbow, with the bolt still loaded.
"It's worth more to you than it is to me. Prefect Pankal, take it, Dahlia. When this place really turns against us, this M-suit of mine isn't going to make much difference. But your armor might buy you a little time.
Like it did with Koba. Better a second or two than nothing at all. Have the crossbow." Sparva reached out to take her empty weapon and hefted it. I've still got a club. You'd be surprised what I can do with a club. An order had been given, so she accepted it, nodding once in acknowledgement at the transaction that had taken place.
Thank you, sir. I won't make the same mistake twice.
You see those doors? Sparva said, nodding at the base of the shell house. That's our objective. I can't promise it's going to be any safer in there than out here, but I'd still sooner take that chance. They were moving again. Perek taking the lead this time, sweeping her crossbow around, Sparva feeling the nervous energy coming off her, only ever a twitch away from firing. They left the rock gardens behind, setting out across an open area encircling the building, where all the paths converged. Perhaps the building was a forlorn hope, he told himself, just as likely to be made of quick matter as the rest of their environment. Perhaps its very walls would bleed more cats, or something worse. But where there was a possibility of shelter, of establishing some bridgehead, he could not ignore it. Besides, one of the objectives of an enforcement action was the securing of evidence. If there was evidence in the shell house, he was duty-bound to record it, even if none of his observations ever made it back to Panoply. They were nearing the raised terrace when the cats came back. Perek saw them first, pooling out of the distant margin of the jungle, black ink blots, coalescing into animal forms, moving with the low-shouldered gait of confident predators in clear sight of their prey. Two cats, then three. Three cats for one bolt. Sparva almost laughed. There was no hope of reaching the shell house now. "You should run, sir," Perek said, as the cats gathered speed, approaching along one of the converging paths. "You'll be faster in that M-suit. I'll hold them back as best I can."
"No,"
he answered, doubting very much that he would be faster. "We don't run. Not now. We hold this line as best we're able.
Sir, it's all right, Dahlia. The game was loaded against us. We shouldn't feel too bad about it."
He was impressed with the way Perek held her nerve, waiting until she had a clear shot at the nearest of the cats, taking down one of them when it was only a dozen bounds away, the cat splashing down into a flattened black puddle, the other two moving through it with gathering strides. By now, both of their crossbows were useless except as clubs, but they raised them anyway, even as the cat seemed to compress in on themselves before launching into the air. One of them took Perek, the other Sparva. At the first clawing impact, his crossbow was wrenched from his grip, sent spinning away. The cat hammered him to the ground. Perek groaned, and a smear of red washed across Sparva's vision. Someone's blood. It could have been his, but he wasn't sure. That was one of the odd ironies of his existence. When you got down to corpuscles, humans and hyperpigs weren't so unalike. Chapter 21 Dreyfus detected the shift in his weight, which heralded the elevator's imminent arrival at the base of the shaft. He turned to Garlin, managing a laconic smile as he met the other man's gaze through the visors of their M-suits. "Any second now, one of us is going to have the great pleasure of proving the other one wrong. I hope you're ready for it, Julius."
"Oh, I'm ready. I've never been more ready.
Nice show of strength, but I know a chink of doubt when I see one."
The elevator arrived with a soft bump, the airlock starting to sequence almost immediately. Dreyfus touched a reassuring hand against the two whiphounds he carried, preparing himself for whatever lay just beyond. The inner and outer doors opened. A prefect, in full tactical armor, was waiting on the other side of the lock, a fist raised, as if they had been hammering against the door until the moment it opened. The prefect almost fell into the elevator. Dreyfus caught a stenciled name, Singh, and some dim association brought a face to mind, one of the intake of 23 or 24, or maybe a year or two earlier. A good kid, he thought absently, one of the more promising candidates for rapid promotion. Dreyfus grabbed Singh before she stumbled.
"Singh, it's Dreyfus. What the hell's happening? Where is the rest of your squad?"
"Close it, sir. Get the elevator going back up. They're still out there."
Dreyfus took Singh's beak-visored helmet between his hands.
"Singh, listen to me."
He snarled out her name.
"Singh!
Where are the others? Gone, sir. It got Gurney. Took him. I don't know about the rest. Comms went bad after the cat.
The cat? Dreyfus frowned, wondering if he might have misheard.
What do you mean, cat? We've got to get back up the shaft. Call in Panoply.
We are Panoply, Singh, you and me, the first and last line. Now slow down and tell me what's happened here. Devi, isn't it?
Deepa, sir. Devi was in the stream above me. Deepa, Singh.
Yes, I remember. I taught you situational processing.
Garland leaned in. Whether she wants to take the elevator back up or not, Dreyfus, it isn't happening. The controls have just frozen. Looks like we're stuck here.
Did you bring weapons, sir?
Singh asked. Nothing out of the ordinary besides dual whip-hands.
Ought we have?
It's wrong here, sir. Singh twisted back to look over her shoulder, as if she expected something to come at them. It looks like a jungle, but it's not. It's a huge mass of quick matter. The cats were part of it. We couldn't conjure it, couldn't make it safe. Our whip-hounds started to malfunction, and then Prefect Perek. She sent Gurney and me back for help, sir, to call in heavy enforcement. We were trying to get back up the shaft, to reach Pell, but the elevator was gone, and then the cats came again. All we had was these.
She raised the object that Dreyfus had barely noticed until then, a crossbow. Dreyfus noted that the crossbow had already discharged. What happened?
I shot one of the cats. When the dart hit, the cat stopped. Died, I suppose. But Gurney missed, and there was still another cat. It took Gurney into the jungle. There wasn't anything I could do. I was just hoping the elevator would get here in time.
Let me see the crossbow, Garland said.
We have to move, sir, Singh said to Dreyfus, offering the weapon to the other man. It's still out there. Others too. Prefect Perek said they were having trouble. She'd seen the cats. She told us not to engage. I hope they're all right.
Garland caressed a hand along the smooth, seamless lines of the crossbow.
Is this a trick, Dreyfus?
Why would it be?
I know what this is.
Behind his visor, Garland's face tightened at the arrival of some unwelcome recollection.
I think I made one like it once. I remember shaping the quick matter, getting it to form the design I had in mind.
He kept staring at the crossbow, lost in some rapture of amazement and horror.
You were here, Dreyfus said softly, feeling a strange and distant sympathy for Garland.
This place, it's where you learned everything that made you what you were.
Something happened,
Garland said, lowering the crossbow, but still holding it by its stock.
Something bad.
Anger flared in his eyes.
What the hell have you done to me?
Shown you a door.
Dreyfus turned back to Singh. The cat that you killed. There's a pit outside, sir. Stairs leading up, then a clearing. That's where I shot the cat, where it fell. If it's still there.
If the dart kills cats, then we need that dart, Dreyfus said.
It's still just one bolt, sir. I think it was luck that I got that cat at all. Gurney's got a much better sidearm rating than me and... I mean, Gurney was...
Singh, Dreyfus said sharply,
sensing that she was on the brink of falling apart.
Deeper. Listen to me. Remember what I taught you. Your situational processing class.
He heard Singh take a deep breath. You said there was no situation so bad that we were ever justified in giving up, sir.
Correct. Dreyfus spoke slowly, calmly. We have suits and air, and the entire resources of Panoply ready to swoop in on Lethe any moment now. You've proven that this environment has rules.
He gave her a sharp pat on the shoulder.
Now let's see if that cat's still where you left it.
And me? Garland asked. Dreyfus took the crossbow from him and passed it back to Singh.
I'd stick with her.
Outside the elevator was the sheer-walled pit that she had described, with a set of blocky stairs climbing to the surface at the other end of it. Singh went up first, pausing as she approached the top, cautiously raising her head over the rim, then scrambling up onto the level ground with the crossbow still in hand. I can see the body, sir. It's still there.
Any sign of the other one?
Singh looked around. I think we're all right for the moment. But we're going to have to get close to the edge of the clearing, and it could be hiding.
Then we'll be sharp about it, Dreyfus said.
He followed Singh up the stairs, taking only the briefest of moments to assess his surroundings. Blue sky above, with a barely detectable trace of domed curvature. Dense green foliage hemming an open area. The leaves, ferns, and vines almost glowing with an inner luminosity. It was unreal. A dream made manifest.
"It wasn't like this when we got here," Singh said.
Dreyfus settled his gaze onto the puddle of black that was his objective. "I'll retrieve the dart. Do you remember where it went in?"
"Just behind the shoulder. On the left side."
"Good." He nodded at Garlin, who was standing with his hands on his hips, looking around with a dazed look on his face. "Stay with Prefect Singh." Dreyfus deployed the first of his two whiphounds in a moving cordon and jogged to the cat, crouching low as he approached, ready to make an immediate retreat. He could only see a few centimeters into that thick green curtain, and yet that was enough to convince him of its full and belligerent potential, a machine that now had him in his gears. He forced his attention to the corpse, a black form, like a cat-shaped hole, punched into some other reality. He had assumed that its details would become more pronounced as he neared it, but even now his eyes seemed to slide off it, finding no purchase. It had no depth, no texture, no gradations of light and shade. He reached out, his gloved fingers seeming to stretch into a bottomless void, before they contacted the hard tail of the dart. If the cat and the crossbow were made of quick matter, then in all likelihood, so was the dart. But it felt solid and metallic in his fingers, and tugged loose with only a pop of resistance. He closed his fist around it and jogged back to the others, stooping from breathlessness when he arrived, the whiphound scooting to his side. Sparva heard the voice before he placed its origin. He was lying on the ground, playing dead after coming round from unconsciousness, certain that this subterfuge remained the only survival option open to him, however slight its chances of success. He had assumed it was only a matter of time before the cats came back for him, finishing off their brutal business. He was weaponless now, exhausted and shocked. The only mystery was why they had left him alive in the first place. Dahlia Perek was silent, but he could still hear her moans playing through his head. Yet the voice was insistent.
"You can get up, pigman. I see you for what you are. Something ridiculous, even if you weren't lying in the dirt like a discarded toy. But you're not one of them. You carry the burden of crimes committed against your kind, but you were not, as far as I am aware, the direct perpetrator of crimes against others."
A kind, solicitous tone entered the voice.
"You may stand. If you and I have business, and that may be the case, the nature of it has yet to be determined."
Footsteps padded softly on grass. A pair of shoes came into view, belonging to legs that rose up and beyond Sparva's immediate field of view.
"Prefect," the voice said, lower now. "Let's put aside the pretense, shall we?
It's not very dignified, lying like that. Not a very fitting posture for someone who has come this far, against such odds. You deserve better than to lie there in the dirt like a dead thing."
The figure stepped closer. A shadow fell across the ground, and Sparva felt a hand close around the scruff of his neck, grasping him by the M-suit.
"Here, let me help you to your feet."
Sparva was yanked from the ground in one smooth movement, the speaker letting out only a tiny grunt of effort as he bore Sparva's weight.
"Now, pigman, stand. At least we can make an effort to look each other in the eye, can't we?"
Blood still smeared the M-suit visor. Now he was standing, it began to run off the self-cleaning surface. Through this dissipating pink film, Sparva stared at the man who had hauled him off the ground. He was familiar, and yet not so. He had the face of Devon Garlin, but there was a maturity to it that was absent from the face of the public figure. The countenance was slightly broader and heavier, somewhat more blemished and lined, markedly more characterful, as if it had lived more and seen more than its bland public counterpart. The eyes were wearier, sunk more deeply in their sockets, the skin around them more elaborately wrinkled, the eyelids heavier and more sagging. There was no scar beneath the right eye. Above the eyes, the brow had more lines to it, and the forehead was more prominent. the hair wirier and starting further up the scalp. Sparva might not have been the best at telling humans apart, but even with his limitations, he felt that this was unquestionably the face of the same man. But with decades more life added to it, and little evidence of rejuvenative procedures being used to undo the effects of aging. Beneath the head, a thick, muscular neck, a barrel-chested torso, strong arms and shoulders, the sturdy, top-heavy physique barely concealed beneath a plain black outfit of trousers and tunic, devoid of frills or ornamentation, and yet unquestionably the face and body of the same man he had helped detain in Fuchs in Nymburk. "How are you here, Devon?" Sparva asked. Puzzlement pushed a notch into the man's forehead.
"Why do you call me that?"
"Because I've seen you before. Everyone has. You're Julius Devon Garlinvoy.
And yet by your tone, you seem not to be wholly certain of that assertion.
I took you to Panoply. You've been there ever since." The man bit down on his lower lip, ruminating on this point.
"Then it would seem unlikely that I am here as well, would it not?"
"You're older, bulkier, but I've seen your face on 1,000 broadcasts."
"And your point is?"
The man still had his hand on Sparva's neck, but he released it now. Then, with a detached, practical manner, as of one cleaning the face of a clock, or brushing dust from a portrait, he began to unpeel the front of Sparva's visor. The M-suit material was tearing and shriveling at the touch of his fingers, breaking away in smoky threads.
"There, there," the man said. "You don't need this encumberment, not here.
You can breathe easily without it, and at least we can look each other squarely in the eye, can't we?" "How are you doing that?" Sparva asked, as the man dabbed away more and more of the M-suit, flicking its gluey traces off the tips of his fingers like someone punching through a cobweb.
"You established the nature of the jungle and the cats, didn't you? It's all quick matter, just like this suit of yours, and there's nothing I can't do with quick matter. I am just willing it to surrender its integrity, and so it does."
The man smiled. It was the smile Sparva had come to despise like a repeated lash against old, raw nerve endings.
"But don't fear, pig man. I haven't allowed you to come all this way just to kill you now."
Sparva forced himself to take in Peric's body, what he could see of it. Her tactical armor melted and deformed where the quick matter had attacked it.
"Then why did they have to die?" "I only needed a single witness."
"You're as good as any. Better, as I have said, in that you are more blameless than many." "Are you blameless, pig man? What's your title exactly?"
"Prefect Bankal, and you are under Panoply observance."
"Yes." "Good. I admire your rectitude, your devotion to the calling, against all the visible odds. But your friends are dead, Prefect, and you are powerless. Turn around, will you?" When Sparva did not turn around, the man took him by the shoulders and forced him to obey. He studied the pale pearl-white gleam of the shell house, its spiraling organically inspired contours.
"Do you recognize it, Prefect Bankal?"
"I don't know."
"How many guesses do I get?"
The man punched Sparva in the small of his back. The force of the punch sent Sparva sprawling forward, snout down in the dirt, feeling as if a battering ram had just been driven into the base of his spine. The man's shadow fell over him again. Then he felt fingers close around the scruff of his neck once more. But there was no M-suit to muffle the hold now, and the pain of fingers digging into flesh made Sparva let out a small, shocked grunt, even as he landed back on his feet.
"Ground rules," the man said. "You are here at my sufferance, Prefect, and my forbearance is not without its limits. There is nothing so fragile as the tolerance of a man who knows with complete conviction that he is going to die."
"Do you?"
Sparva asked, wheezing out the words.
"Well, of course. They won't let me live, will they? Not now, when there is so little to be gained by not allowing me to die. They will decide that any operatives still present in Lethe are regrettably expendable, understandable, given the lack of contact, and order Lethe's total destruction. We both know they have the means.
The remaining wildfire cases will die, as Panoply surely knows, but they will console themselves that nothing could be done to save those people anyway. You're wrong. We have a plan to save them. It's already working.
How little you know, the man said almost fondly, as if he might pat Sparver on the head at any moment. The means to preserve those people lies with me. Not Panoply. Every day, every hour, by force of will, I choose to permit them to live. I am in their heads, whispering the spell that stops them from dying. If I cease to whisper that spell, because I choose not to, or because I am dead, then they will die. It is as simple as that. I don't see what you'd gain from being dead. You misunderstand my intentions. I have already achieved all that I desired. The wildfire emergency has sown terror and confusion, and it is not yet finished. No one, even you, can really be sure who is next. Does it really end with the names on the list? I'll let you in on a little secret, shall I? I only ever touched those 2,000 citizens. No one else need fear wildfire when it finally burns through that list of names. There will be no more deaths, at least not as a direct consequence of the clinic. I'll have had my justice. But it won't end there. Not for Panoply, not for the Glitter Band. Public confidence in your organization couldn't be lower, Prefect. But it's only going to get worse when the people see how ineffective you were in the face of this emergency. The breakaway movement will hasten. There will be misjudgments, overreactions on both sides, regrettable acts, provocation and counter-provocation. Wiser minds will attempt to slow the fragmentation, even turn it back. But that wheel, once started turning, will not be easy to stop. The Glitter Band will begin to destroy itself, riven by centrifugal forces of naked greed and craven self-interest.
I'm glad you've thought this through.
This drew wry amusement from the man, rather than another punch to the spine.
Oh, I have. Thoroughly. But unlike my brother, the man you think you know, the man whose face reminded you of my own, unlike him, I'm under no illusions that there is an upside to this chaos.
Caleb, you see, for all his faults, and there are many, Caleb still has an idealistic streak. Mistaken, foolhardy, but sincerely held, he thinks he can make the world a better place, and I have helped him along in that conviction. Opened doors for him, you might say. Given him a little helping hand without his knowledge.
Who is Caleb?
You know him, Prefect. Weren't you the one who detained him?
I detained Julius Devon Garland Voy,
Sparver said.
No,
the man answered. That was Caleb. I ought to know.
I am Julius Devon Garland Voy. I am, and always have been.
Load it, Dreyfus said. Prefect Singh primed the crossbow, latched it, and slid the dart back into its groove, folding a small retaining clip down over it.
Did you really make this? She asked Garlin.
Yes. He nodded, something between shame and pride in his features. I could make another one now, if we had time. It's just quick matter. I was always pretty good at conjuring it. I wasn't the best, though.
Caleb was, Dreyfus said, drawing a reproachful glance from Garland.
Yet no contradiction for now.
Who are you, sir?
Singh asked. He's Devon Garland, Dreyfus answered, guessing that she had already worked out most of the truth for herself.
Julius Devon Garland Voy, presently a witness in the wildfire emergency.
Julius was raised here, Deeper, along with his brother Caleb. It's an exact copy of the Voy residence in Chasm City. Julius doesn't remember too much of what happened, but it's starting to become clearer, isn't it?
I don't remember Caleb, Garland said, but without the flat denial of earlier. But I do know this place, and there was always someone else here. I didn't play those games on my own.
He paused, swallowed. There was a game that involved hunting. One of us made animals. We chased them down for sport. But it wasn't like that cat.
They weren't solid. They weren't real. They were just figments.
Consensual hallucinations, Dreyfus said. Real enough to the eye, but incapable of harming you back. Something obvious.